days of racing permitted in any county, those days of racing conducted by Pacific International Livestock Exposition up to 10 days, declares an emergency.
We're going to have a short one, I hope, on Senate Bill 555. Martin, you want to explain this?
I'm Bill Martin, and I'm the general manager for the Pacific International Livestock. Basis in which they can continue the program. The program can be to improve the facility.
recall that this was this quarter of $1 million was to be repaid.
5 hours, and we finally got back to the definition of the first one we started on.
Put on a bunch of accomplishments.
Well, I don't know. The model penal code takes 10 years, so I don't know. Okay. Well, now, building means any structure, vehicle, or place customarily occupied by persons lodging or carrying on business therein, whether or not the person is actually present.
Well, the thing that I complain about is writing something that people can read and understand that don't know anything about the law. When you say a building is anything, you're not making sense. But why not say protected property instead of a building?
That reminds me of a good idea. An attorney general's opinion which made a very slight differentiation between bathrooms and bedrooms not some time ago.
But what we're talking about is protected property, isn't it? Under this statute. Then I don't mind.
How's that again?
The words protected property instead of building.
Yeah, what's protected property?
We go on to say
that. You go on and use the same
stuff.
Actually, okay.
Instead of using the building, right. Completely out of context with what the word means.
All right.
Okay.
All right. Protected property includes any structure, vehicle, or building.
Yeah, you could have building.
Well, like
they have building or place.
Structure.
That's a building.
Structure.
Place or thing.
Structure,
vehicle,
place or
thing.
Ordinarily occupied by the people or something.
Customarily occupied by people or used by people for the carrying on of business therein.
Mm-hmm. Why do you have to limit the carrying on business?
Yeah, this bothers me.
Yeah, now you don't have to. You've got the structure customarily occupied by people. That's
structure,
the whole story.
Structure, yeah. Place or thing, customarily occupied by people.
I don't think that's business.
Customarily occupied by people, period. First degree arson. Person commits first degree arson if, by starting a fire or causing an explosion, he intentionally damages any protected property as defined in subsection.
We'll even add. We can go one step farther now and remove the definition of forest lands by saying protected property includes any structure, place, thing, or forested lands.
Or forested.
Yeah.
Land.
Right. Yeah.
All right, and then do we define forested land?
Yeah.
Or do we say forested land as defined by ORS 777001?
Yeah, sure. Now you're talking.
That makes it look like we really did our homework. I looked up the other section.
It typifies it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
First degree arson is the intentional burning of any protected property or the intentional burning of any property if it causes bodily injury or imperils life or limb.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
second degree is
burning
forest land.
Well, no. First degree would be forest land because forest lands would be.
But only if it's.
No.
Only if it causes bodily injury or...
We're putting forest lands, and sometimes we've said public buildings, in a category of property all by themselves.
They
don't need to hurt people. They'd be likely to hurt people because they're so sacred to the state of Oregon.
Right. And then in second degree, we would... the intentional if by starting a fire or causing an explosion you intentionally damage
what? Unprotected property.
No.
Because you have protected property in
that's
the books.
Nothing left.
There's nothing left.
That's a problem then.
We moved forest land up into first degree and we've eliminated everything else.
He's got nothing but first degree.
Well,
Well, you've got second, third, if you want to go to negligence and recklessness. All right. I'm not sure that's so bad.
Did you get that, Mildred? No, I mean, did you get the definition that we've been working on?
You don't need
don't
to
laugh, but just
you don't need to understand. Just put your back.
Just get it down.
Second degree could be the intention of the burning of building that isn't customarily occupied by people, like farms, railroad cattle cars.
Which results in death, injury to another, or is likely to result in injury.
Just the intentional burning of it, period. I think
all other intentional.
I think the causing of bodily injury and the imperiling of a human should both be first degree.
Then all other intentional burning would become second degree.
Yeah.
And then reckless burning would become third degree, and negligent would become fourth.
Well, except we decided that we didn't want to tar the negligent or reckless burner with the tag of arson.
Well, then why don't we have first and second only under the heading of arson, and then don't have arson and reckless burning, but have arson and a fine first and second, and then have another chapter which is reckless burning. And then under reckless burning, have negligence burning.
All right, have arson, section 1, as used in this chapter or whatever, protected property means whatever you said, including forest land is defined by 477 old whatever, public buildings by 479, whatever, period. And then plus this, we somehow are going to have to work in this business of the separate apartments, offices, with rented rooms.
I don't think that's important.
All that is now is for the purpose of creating a whole bunch of charges where one really ought to do it.
All right, so strike that. And then that would be the only definition. Then you have section 2 would be second degree, section 3 would be first degree, period. And then we would have a separate chapter entitled Reckless Burning.
Reckless and Negligent Burning.
And Negligent Burning.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think we're going to end up with separate chapters.
All right.
Because they're going to be codified into one chapter.
Separate heading.
Because legislative councils pick all of them.
Well, but it's never heading.
Arson could be one section.
And then reckless.
All crimes by burning. Crime by fire. Something else. And then get your separate heading.
You get the spirit of the law, if not the letter, don't you?
Yeah, that's a good idea. The heading would be crimes by fire. And then the first section would be arson. And the second section would be reckless burning. And the third one would be negligent.
Now you know how I feel when I read the letters to the editor every morning.
I somehow feel like I have lost control here.
This subcommittee, this runaway subcommittee.
There's no question about it. No fight.
Well, let me suggest this. Because I think we have reached the point in which I can tell a joke to you. But anyway, what we've just gone over the last time should be very easy. Pull out off the tape or out of the minutes and to put down on paper. It doesn't need any commentary to accompany it. But why don't you pull that out, type something up, and send us copies of it, and leave some white space on there.
Don't do it. Take it clear out of the edge.
Yeah.
Get to the top of the bottom.
And we should get those within a week, and we'll write back to you.
If we don't write back, you're assuming we agree.
And then, based upon the comments that you get, prepare another draft. I just don't see where else we can go. We've got to get over this section. And seems to me that this protected property concept makes quite a bit of sense. We are getting away from the traditional common law aspect of placing a premium on the dwelling house.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's good.
Yeah, the only reason they did was because the dwelling house contained people, and we've enlarged it to include everything.
Yeah, well, I was trying to do that to start off with. Yeah, so I certainly don't object to that.
Well, I think this is good because we're not calling
a bicycle
or a railroad car a building.
Yeah.
And this makes a lot of sense to me. If you want to place a premium on forest lands or public buildings, say what you mean, and let's have our definitions be consistent with what we presently have in the code, if that's okay. And
what definitions do you mean?
I'm talking about forest lands and public buildings. You see, those two.
Which means now, if you're consistent with what's in the code now, you want to put back in there what we took out previously in the forest land about the fire hazard part of that definition? Or do you want to leave it the way we would?
You don't put it back in except by reference.
We put it back in by reference. So leave it in by reference.
Yeah.
And you create less construction problems later on.
Okay, so you're changing your mind from what you voted on before.
Oh, of course.
Okay.
Yeah,
I just want to be sure that I know what we've done.
You bet
you. Leave lots of room in the margin.
All right. Well, let's do that. Draw a knockout a draft and send it to us. Each of us will individually favor you with our critique of it. And we better set another meeting, I can think, within 3 weeks. Get over it. I just don't think we can really afford to get hung up on this. We've got to make more progress the next time.
We've made so much in the last 10 minutes, I wonder if we just couldn't clean up robbery by 3 seconds.
Well... I'm willing, if you want to get into it.
Get into robbery?
Yeah. Whatever you want to do.
Well, I just...
That was quite a long time to get wound up with.
I just wondered if it might not save us a day or part of the day sometime later.
Yeah.
We've shot this one.
What's our problem with robbery?
No.
The commission wanted us to do two things. They wanted us to deal with the situation or to make it clear what our thinking was with respect to the deadly or dangerous weapon situation or an aggravating element of robbery and whether or not we meant loaded guns. We meant what we meant by deadly weapons or what we meant by dangerous weapons. And also to indicate the kind of robbery it would be if a robber pretends that he is armed or represents that he is armed in some way where in fact he is not armed. In other words, our robbery draft that we had sent on to the commission, the main thrust of that draft was that the actual
threat or danger to the victim. And it was not intended to make it robbery in the first degree to hold up somebody with a fake gun or something. But there was quite a bit of discussion about that at the commission. And part of them seemed to feel that, this is my understanding from the minutes and what was said there, part of them seemed to feel, for example, Don Clark said that he thought that we should be concerned with the actual threat to the individual. That's what why robbery was serious. Whereas some of the other members felt it was a question of the effect on the victim, the fright that was caused to the victim of the robbery, whether or not the person was actually, the robber was actually armed with a weapon or not. So what I've attempted to do here in this draft is to hit a middle ground. And robbery in the third degree would is really not changed. It's not changed any, except that I've made another degree of robbery here. You would have 3 degrees of robbery instead of 2. And robbery in the second degree would be the main change that would be made, and that would take care of the toy gun situation. The representation that you're armed, when in fact you may not be. Wouldn't be an element of the crime to prove that he was in fact armed or that he made any attempt to use a weapon. It's just that if he threatened the immediate use of a dangerous weapon by any verbal, written, or other representation, the idea being that he says, I've got a gun, or if he hands somebody a note saying, I've got a gun.
Or if he shows what looks like a gun.
Yeah. What are we calling that now? What are we doing?
Unarmed robbery, 15 years. Robbery by force and violence, not being armed with dangerous weapons.
Right. And are we downgrading it by this? Are we downgrading that act?
No, we actually are upgrading it.
We're having a section now as we didn't have before, which is acting like you're armed when before, if you just acted like you're armed, you were in it.
The toy gun situation now would be unarmed robbery. Even though the victim might think you've got an actual gun there, that's unarmed robbery.
It really is. That's what you're charging him now.
Yeah. I see. But yeah. Some of the commission members felt that should make it more serious.
Well, yeah.
More serious than if they didn't represent they were armed, but threatened to use force.
So I tried to slip it in here in the middle and say that it's going to be more serious if you pretend you're armed, even though you're not.
But you still get a little bit of dividend because you didn't arm yourself and pulls out a little crumb for him
for being a good boy and not going armed.
And that's what I think what's wrong with some of these other codes is that where they create a prima facie case against you by a representation. You might just as well be armed as not.
Yeah,
you
don't get the dividend.
It seems to me that might encourage armed robberies rather than discourage them. Right? If you're going to go in there and pretend you're armed, you might just as well be armed because you're going to be as guilty one way or another.
And you're being the same danger.
What are we thinking about now? The effect on the victim. Right. What we're worried about is the victim's willingness.
Well,
give up something because
we're worried about 2 or 3 things. That's one of the things, and we're also worried about encouraging possible or would-be robbers not to really arm themselves.
I'm going to spread this around all the dropouts in high school when I leave. Get the top of this statute.
On page 2 of my commentary, I indicate that section 2 represents the most significant difference from the earlier draft. That makes the threatening of immediate use of a dangerous weapon constitute the aggravated crime of robbery in the second degree. While such a threat by a robber who is in fact unarmed does not create any greater risk to the victim, it is common knowledge that it does heighten the terror in the victim's mind and is persuasive in overcoming resistance to the robbery. This section would cover the instances in which the robber used the note, the hand in the pocket technique, or a fake weapon to convey the impression that he is armed. It should be noted that under the provisions of Section 2, the state would not be required to prove that the defendant was actually armed or that he had used or attempted to use a weapon. It is submitted, however, that since there is no more danger to the victim than would exist under robbery in the third degree, the mere threat to use a dangerous weapon
weapon standing alone should not raise the crime of first degree robbery. The primary aim of the proposal is nonetheless prophylactic because it subjects the robber who uses, for example, a toy gun to a more severe penalty. Well, that's my opinion.
Now, where was that covered under the, where was that covered under draft two? Under robbery in the second degree?
Yeah, it would have been second degree as robbery in the first draft, although it wasn't set out in so many words. The first degree robbery under the first draft was intended to cover situations where there was either the defendant's actually armed with a deadly weapon or used a...
First degree robbery in our previous draft is identical to first degree robbery in this draft.
No.
I'm talking about the drafts that were submitted to the commission. Preliminary draft two.
Yeah, robbery in the first degree differs from the one that was submitted to the commission. And the reason I changed it is that I changed language in sub two. And that appears on page 2 of the commentary also. Section 3 has been amended by changing the language that appears in subsection 2 of preliminary draft 2, which said, uses or threatens the immediate use of a dangerous weapon, to uses or attempts to use a dangerous weapon. This distinguishes the conduct from that prohibited by section 2 and requires the defendant actually to have the weapon in his possession and to go so far as to attempt to make use of it. Yeah, my idea.
Under section 3, then a gun becomes a deadly weapon if it's loaded, and a dangerous weapon if it's just carried in the hand, you've got to beat the guy with a head with it.
It's an armed with a deadly weapon, or uses or attempts to use a dangerous weapon.
No.
Would that be correct?
There's a difference between deadly and dangerous.
That's what I say. It'd be deadly if you had it loaded, and dangerous if you just beat the guy with a head with it.
Yeah. Now, I say that I...
But it's the same thing.
Same thing.
I mean,
You're guilty if you're armed with a gun that's loaded.
Yeah.
Even though you don't attempt to use it.
Yeah.
And we don't destroy the presumption that every gun is loaded.
Now, if you've got an unloaded gun, you have to haul out and hit somebody with it before you're...
If you have an unloaded gun, there's a presumption that it was loaded under the case law in Oregon. And it's incumbent upon the defendant to prove that it was unloaded. And if it was unloaded, it could be construed as a dangerous instrument because it's capable of causing...
Yeah, but he would have to have attempt to use it in that manner if he can prove that it's unloaded.
Right. All right, and if he can't, and if there's no evidence that he attempted to use it in that manner, then, in that event, he disproved that it was loaded, so it's not a deadly weapon.
He kept
it in his pocket, and so he didn't threaten its use.
He's third down to third degree.
So we go down to third degree.
He threatened to use it. Yeah.
The very fact of possession that it was known to the victim would, I suppose, be a threat to the
victim. Yeah. I would think so.
That'd be section 2. Second.
Yeah, if he makes any representation.
He's got it.
Yeah, and if he doesn't make any representation, he hasn't done much of anything.
That's right. Yeah, that'd be second degree. Yeah. That's good. And if he has any representation, you're just going to take him to third degree robbery.
Yeah,
assume he commits robbery.
How will we approve preliminary draft number 3 of robbery?
No, wait a minute. Just a second.
Are you going to be a troublemaker, Mr. Chairman? Now, I want you to understand.
Tab Redburn would say
that I've made certain assumptions here about this. And, of course, we've talked about this deadly and dangerous weapon definition before. Now, it's interesting to note that the present Oregon statutes, some of them use the terminology dangerous weapons, and some of them use the terminology deadly weapon. As near as I can determine, the case law really doesn't distinguish between the two. I mean, the cases, even with respect to deadly weapons, construe it in such a manner that a dangerous, their definition of dangerous weapon means the same thing, and that is that certain, there are certain weapons that are dangerous weapons as a matter of law, such as a loaded gun or a knife,
knuckle duster, or
some of the, anything that's used within striking distance to the victim is a deadly weapon or a dangerous weapon. And I assume that our definitions will have something similar to what I've set out here in the commentary to show you the New York definition of deadly weapon means any loaded weapon from which a shot readily capable of producing death or other serious bodily injury may be discharged, or a switchblade knife, gravity knife, billy, blackjack, or metal knuckles. Dangerous instrument means any instrument, article, or substance, including a vehicle, as that term is defined in this section, which, under the circumstances in which it is used, attempted to be used, or threatened to be used, is readily capable of causing death or other serious physical injury. The Michigan draft employs definitions that are almost identical, but adds bludgeon and slingshot to its list of deadly weapons. The model penal code does not differentiate between armed and unarmed robbery, therefore a definition is not required therein. However, their section 210, for the purposes of offenses against the person, their assaults, crimes, defines deadly weapon to mean any firearm or other weapon, device, instrument, material, or substance, whether animate or inanimate, which in the manner it is used or is intended to be used, is known to be capable of producing death or serious bodily injury.
Now, does that mean unloaded or unloaded?
I like that last definition better, excepting that I don't like the limitation of be capable of producing death. Almost anything is capable of it. Iceberg is capable of producing death, or so is the hypodermic needle.
Well, yeah, and the manner it's used. But well, some of the Oregon cases, for example, have defined a broken beer bottle or just a beer bottle that's used to eat somebody.
That's a dangerous weapon.
A dangerous weapon.
But not a weapon.
Or a flashlight.
Well, let me put the motion in a minute. And at the risk of being a troublemaker, let me tell you what bothers me. The present Oregon statute makes it armed robbery for any person who assaults another, and that would be going into the bank and store and saying, give me your money, being armed with a dangerous weapon. And the what we try to discourage by making this the highest degree of offense, and we try to discourage people from committing a crime by employing or using a dangerous weapon. Now, we want to discourage these armed robbers, from committing these crimes by being, while being armed, because in the excitement of the moment, you might inadvertently use it and hurt somebody, whether they initially intended to or not. Now, using the example that I brought up a little while ago, the guy goes in and holds up a store, and he has a gun, he has it in his pocket, and if he threatens the immediate use of it by a verbal representation, doesn't pull it out, he threatens it by a verbal representation, immediately there's a presumption that it's loaded. And that hints it would be a deadly weapon. All right, first degree. If it's shown by evidence at the trial that it wasn't loaded, that is, if the police officer at cross examination confiscated and testified that it was incapable of being fired. Then it's a dangerous weapon, but he didn't attempt to use it, So do we fall back to robbery in the second degree in that instance?
He didn't say anything about having a gun.
Yeah, he said he had. He said, I've got a gun in my pocket.
Well, they made a representation.
Second degree.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess I have no problem. I just want to make sure that we're not
letting somebody squeeze through all three.
Yeah. And that we're not by employing the distinction between deadly and dangerous, not encouraging maybe robbers to harm themselves on the theory that, by golly, I can put this in my pocket, and if I don't have to pull it out and use it, the most I can get charged with is second degree. See what I mean? And the baby,
of course, if he's carrying a loaded revolver.
He's armed with it.
He's running the risk of first degree robbery, whether he tries to use it or not.
That's right.
And if it isn't loaded, he ought to get a dividend.
If it's loaded and he keeps it in his pocket, nobody knows he's got it. Well, you haven't fight anybody with it.
Then he's third degree.
He's thought about it. No, but then
he's third degree. Now, why is he third degree? He hasn't done a damn thing.
Well, he's committed robbery.
Oh, he... By attempting to use physical force, he didn't include that. Threatened the immediate...
Well, he compelled the owner to deliver the property.
By threatening to use force.
Well, I would think that even if he didn't make any reference to it, he was guilty of one, and it was found that he had
a bust on the nose.
And had a gun on him, loaded, and he could be charged with
first degree.
All right, before I put the motion, I want to ask Don if he gave any real serious consideration to the problems and the possible problems that might arise as a result of phraseology to sub 4, section 3.
He made it by another person actually present. We talked about that.
Well, the commission didn't recommend that be changed. We did that to pretty good grooming, didn't we?
Mm-hmm, we did.
The commission, although that element was discussed considerably, my understanding, the recommendation of the full commission was that this was not one of the things that they asked the subcommittee to do over.
Okay. Well, the motion that we adopt the redraft of robbery as is, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion carried.
Being second.
I think it was made seconded. All right. Meeting adjourned. With the progress we made in the last 15 minutes, do I take my
art? You got a couple other sections here you want to go at?
No,
thanks,
sir.
I went to law school, but after he'd been in practice for 3 or 4 years in the town of Chanute, Kansas, his office was over a bank. And one of the village nuts came in his office one day and demonstrated that he was completely wired with dynamite around his belt and batteries and wires up here to his finger. And had my friend escort him down to the bank, down the roof where they took out some of the bank's money. And then he forced my friend to drive.
What I do is I have a recorder run off. And then
here's the car.
That's like this thing. They had them sign saying that if they
St. George.
In the MCCI, they realized they were scared.
Here's a copy of that crim law.
I found this case.
The Wisconsin case?
Yeah, I did come across the case myself.
Yeah, fine, okay.
You got a pretty good coffee maker.
It was kind of slow this morning, wasn't it?
I saw Tony Wednesday, I guess it was. Wednesday or Thursday. He would have been here, but he had a wedding.
Oh, yeah. Where did you see him? Portland?
Yeah. Oh, he was down on some kind of PUC hearing. And he had a wedding to go to in Nampa, I think, or someplace on Friday. And it just...
Yeah, I talked to him. What was it, Thursday, I guess?
Thursday.
Yeah, Thursday.
Courtney, have you noticed this Wisconsin case? Cafeteria case, you get an either or choice as you're going along. You get a pick McNaughton or
no, I haven't.
Model penal code. And it's the choice that depends on the burden of proof. If you take McNaughton, the state must still prove, assuming that the defendant brings some evidence in, it's still got the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
That you're saying.
But if you take the model penal code, you lose that, and you've got to have the burden of preponderance then.
This is my case law, sir. Sir. I was just going about.
By Supreme Court rule.
Huh.
That is me.
How's the other subcommittee? Have they been keeping you busy?
Number one is going to meet again on arson.
Are they?
For the third time. We really run into something. Oh.
Who's
well, we're going to meet next Saturday, or not next Saturday, but
16th. As I recall, the last draft I read of arson has taken out all that attempt blank. Is it still out of there?
Yeah.
That is, leaving it in as a completely kind of, it's not knowing court aspects of it like there are now.
That's so, right. That would be eliminated.
Because there's no need to be in court
right.
Times.
But we can't really decide what kind of property we want to put in which category.
Was there a basic difference in the other new codes on this?
Well, yeah, they're pretty much all directed at occupied buildings or dwelling type of structures or structures in which people normally are carrying on business. The rationale of most of the arson codes now, the new ones, is the protection of either life itself, the danger to human beings, or particularly cherished types of property. Getting away from arson of personal property, this type of thing. I don't know what it's for.
Yeah.
Did you find your draft?
Yes, I did. Color helps.
Yeah.
are all the subcommittee threes going to be in red?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Guard those the final. How many do I suppose you have? Three. We'll wait about 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, I tried to. He's got an 8-year-old murder case he's working on.
I see. Don, I guess we'll just have Professor Klein started out here.
Well, you want to take care of the minutes?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. Meeting of August 7th first.
Can I have a motion on those? Have you had time to read them in?
I move that we approve them as written.
Okay. Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Professor Platt, if you could go right ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to point out that I've come here as a student this morning because the more I teach, and I'm sure Courtney will agree with this, the more I teach, the more I realize the less I know. And this is an opportunity for me, certainly this morning, to learn. coping with this problem on a practical level, and I believe that the problems with the insanity defense are largely practical and procedural. I think that we ought to put the problem in that perspective this morning. I think I could say that no matter what rule we adopt as an insanity defense, be it the Model Penal Code or remaining with McNaughton or going to Durham, that this isn't really going to make much difference in the number of insanity pleas that are entered here in Oregon. I think we ought to remember that. We're dealing with a very small number of people who actually raise the defense of insanity in comparison to the number of people, of course, who are contesting a criminal action. And to remember further that the number of people who actually contest a criminal action is a very small part of the people arrested. I'm sure this is old news to a lot of you, but I think I want to keep this in mind. The figures run as high as 90% of the people who actually are apprehended for crime, plead guilty or for some reason or another, do not go to trial. So that we're talking about 10 to 15 or 20%, depending on what figures you're reading, who actually plead not guilty and contest their the criminal action. And of this 10%, let's say, a very minute part actually raise a defense of insanity. Now, one is likely to say, well, if that's such a small number of people, why are we worried about it at all? And I suppose one of the good reasons to worry about it is because although it's small in number, it's large in public attention. I don't suppose there's any kind of crime that comes more quickly to the public attention than the kind of a crime that results usually in insanity defense. Normally, in other words, the kind of crime involved is a very heinous offense. It's usually a capital crime. The shocking thing, we can think of them ourselves throughout the country. Recently, the man who killed the 7 or 8 or 10 nurses in Chicago. And these are the kind of crimes that the defendant is pleading insanity. So the public focuses great attention on the insanity defense in these very public kind of trials. And I believe that the public, as a result, comes to believe that the insanity defense really amounts to a lot more than it does. Well, now, in that context, I'd like to make just a couple more remarks, and I'm going to stop lecturing. One of the reasons why people do not plead the insanity defense, no matter what rule, you understand, no matter whether it's Curran or the Model Penal Code or McNaughton or Durham, the reason they don't raise this defense is largely because if they raise it and win, they're successful in their defense of insanity, they face an indeterminate period of detention, usually long, long years in a mental institution because, like Oregon, many states provide that if a defendant is found not guilty by reason of insanity, he may be, in the discretion of the court, committed to state institution. And in many cases, he is committed. And of course, there's no sentence involved. He doesn't get 1 to 5. He gets committed until such time as he is returned to sanity and otherwise discharged by law. And in Oregon, we have a case that says that that means that the defendant who has been found guilty by not reason of insanity and committed must not only show that he's sane within the McNaughton rule, but also must show that he's not dangerous to society. And as a result, it's pretty hard to get out once you've been committed. So the defendants know this. Their lawyers, of course, know this. And that's one of the big reasons that depresses the number of people who qualify for the insanity defense but don't raise it. Who are very sick people, perhaps, but don't raise it because their lawyers say, see the great disadvantage. There are a number of other things that compete with the insanity defense. And I think we ought to keep those in mind because we're going to be dealing with them here in this commission from time to time. And they're actually other parts of the Model Penal Code. One of them, and here again, all these parts of the Model Penal Code outside the insanity defense that I'm going to talk about now are dealing with what's known now as a subjective approach to criminality. And I suppose the
best example of subjective approach to criminality that has a direct connection with the insanity offense is the Wells-Gorsham Doctrine of California, or partial responsibility, reduced responsibility, whatever you want to call it. That is, in brief, if a man is charged with murder in the first degree, the state must show premeditation. The defendant comes in and says, I couldn't premeditate because I had delusions or I had a mental condition short of the McNaughton rule of insanity. Doesn't feel to qualify for the right long test, but he comes in to show that the crime ought to be reduced at least to second degree murder, possibly a manslaughter, because he had this mental disease or defect that kept him from premeditating. Well, now this defense, you can see the competition that it would have with an insanity plea, because if a fellow wins on that, he's assured of a term. He's not going to be faced with an indeterminate detention. He may get a long term, it's true, but at least there's some certainty in what's going to result from that if he's successful. Another example in the Model Penal Code is the departure from the general rules now known in self-defense, and I think this is section, section 3.04, subparagraph 2 of the Model Penal Code now establishes a completely subjective rule for self-defense. Normally the rule is that if the... Now let's see. Now that's correct. Normally the situation is the person put in honest fear? And does he react in a reasonable fashion? This is true of provocation in the manslaughter formula. This is also part of the subjective theory. And the Model Penal Code is now taking the approach of actually looking at the person, the individual, rather than the old applied rule that a man is taken to intend the consequences of his act, which is objective criminality, as we all realize, although it's supposed to be subjective in philosophy, but yet it's objective. Well, if we start looking at the individual's mind, what did that individual, what was his reaction as the person came forward toward him with the axe? Was he old and weak? Was he a coward? And the Model Penal Code is going to take these things into consideration, and if he was, in fact, subject to greater fear, something of this sort, he's going to be allowed to raise this defense. All right, in a lot of cases, the mental disease or defect will cause the lessening of a person's desire or ability to comprehend that he's really not threatened so much in a situation, and therefore he's going to overreact because of a mental disease or defect, short of insanity. As a result, a lot of defendants, now here's a case in self-defense where he gets complete commitment, complete discharge if he's successful. There's no lesser crime involved at all as there is in the partial responsibility doctrine. He raises that self-defense based on his mental disease or defect or mental illness at a particular time, he's off scot-free. Well, obviously, a defendant is going to pursue that kind of an approach if, in fact, the Model Penal Code approach is adopted in this state, rather than the insanity defense. Well, I've said enough, I think, to indicate that there is a great competition going on that draws the people who actually could qualify for legitimate insanity defense away from raising the insanity defense. Many of them are shunted out of the system entirely by policemen or prosecutors at the very outset through civil commitment or through other helping agencies that are called through the community. And they never even reach the criminal process. And those that do reach the criminal process may be drawn away by incompetency to stand trial, for instance. They may be found incompetent because they can't aid themselves or their counsel, and therefore they're committed, and they may never get out of that. They may never become sane enough to be returned for trial. And they're drawn away. They never raise insanity defense. So we're dealing more then, really, than with a substantive formulation of what defense ought to be allowed to these people that society looks at and says they're not responsible for crime, they're not like me, therefore, they ought not to be punished. They're enough different from the rest of us to be treated in a different way, not punished by criminal incarceration, but instead by commitment to a mental institution where they can hopefully receive the kind of care to return them later. Now, on that background, it brings us to the formulation suggested by this report, and this report is quite frankly the adoption of the model penal code section on the subsidy formulation. The person is not responsible for criminal conduct, but at the time of such conduct as a result of mental disease or defect, he lacks substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality of his conduct or to conform his conduct to the requirements of law. There is a second subparagraph of that section, which the model penal code includes, in which I put in brackets, and it reads, it's used in this article, the terms mental disease or defect do not include an abnormality manifested only by repeated criminal or otherwise antisocial conduct, which is squarely aimed at psychopaths or sociopaths, I believe is the equivalent word now being used. I felt, as I explained very briefly and hastily in my notes, that there was no necessity for inserting that as part of the insanity formulation because if, in fact, these people, psychopaths, sociopaths, are going to be able to qualify for the right-wrong test, it doesn't make any difference what you call them or how they act otherwise, that they'll be able to qualify under the first part of the formulation, and therefore, I think that the second subparagraph, I kind of feel it's a propaganda effect to give strength to the adoption of the first part of the formulation. That is, it's to soothe the fears of the district attorneys who might be disturbed about it and the public at large who might be disturbed who think, very erroneously, that there's a great mass of people waiting to assert the insanity defense, which of course is just simply not true. Now, with that in mind, I think I'll withdraw and stop lecturing and start learning. Mr. Chairman?
Thank you.
Yes, sir. I have a question. I have not seen any statistics on numbers of cases in which the insanity defense is asserted and or any figures as to which it succeeds. I wonder if anyone has learned those, or even gathered them. I do not know.
Judge, I can't quote any figures, but I've read some figures someplace on the order of something like that. It was asserted as something like 3% of litigated cases, but I simply can't tell you where I'm not the information.
So I couldn't say the percentage either, but we studied the jury study, you know, Avers and Chicago jury study involved differences on these things, and that was the reaction that they had. It was a relatively rare plea and almost always involved where it was either a capital case or one at least a pretty severe punishment involved. Otherwise, the client might object to have more years in hospital.
I make an observation indirectly about it, Judge. I looked at all the Oregon cases I could find on insanity, and this amounts to some 30 to 35 cases, the ones that I found. And not until 1950s. Was there one successful? And the number actually reaching the Supreme Court is not, I mean, you can't really tell how many are actually in the circuit courts where they're being disposed of. But on that basis, since 1864, even before that, not too many. And certainly not successful.
Well, I've had, in the last 3.5 years, I've had 5 homicide cases of various sorts, and I've had the defense of insanity raised in 3 of them. And in all 3 of these cases, and this is one of the things that disturbs me, is the prosecutor about the insanity defense. There wasn't one of the 3 of them, but what the defense psychiatrist would have felt that this person did not need to be committed. And only 2 of them were found not guilty by reason of insanity, and only 1 was committed by the judge. The other one wasn't even committed after the finding of not guilty by reason of insanity, and the other one was committed only for what the state hospital referred to as a decent period of time because she didn't need to be committed. In their opinion, she was not in. Anything else, so it, but you know, the judge committed her, so they kept her there for somewhere between 30 to 60 days. But they didn't feel she should have been committed anyway. and this is one of the things that disturbs me about insanity. It seems like.
May I ask you at this point, the statutes are, as I read them, are very silent on this point, but who actually may discharge that person? Does it have to be a court order, or may the institution itself discharge?
It's entirely under the discretion of the superintendent. Mm-hmm. That's the way the law reads.
We have one case that I know of, the one I referred to earlier about determining what the qualifications a defendant must have for discharge, and that got to the court on habeas corpus. So there was no way to tell, of course, what the rule was. And I get there isn't a rule, so therefore, as a matter of practice, the institution itself may be discharged.
It seems to me also another figure or statistic would be valuable here if they exist, and that is of those who are committed following acquittal by reason of insanity, of those who are committed to the state hospital, how long do they stay there? And I don't know if Dr. Gleven or would have any figures, or if they have any figures, but it seems to me this would be useful information in evaluating this whole area. I'm sure, as Frank mentioned, there are a good many people who feel that in a number of cases, down there 30, 60, 90 days or 6 months and away you go. And frankly, a lot of people in society don't really believe that's the fella is, the person is so ill as to not be subject to the criminal law, then why don't they keep him longer? I don't know if there are any such things.
Dr. Gleven, you have a comment?
I was thinking the same thing as Professor Pipe was talking, that sort of the myth is you go to the state hospital and you stay there forever, but as you point out, this really isn't the case. And we've never studied this. It would be a relatively simple thing to do. In the 2 years that I've been back at the hospital, I can think immediately of three or four people who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity for wrongful homicide charges, and most of their length of stay is during the time they're getting their legal charges cleared up. They're often sent there because they're not able to stand trial, and we treat them to the point they're well enough to stand trial. And I would say that after they by the time they have gone through the process of being found not guilty, they're pretty well on their way to recovery, a lot of them. So I don't think they'd stay more than a year on the average, or 6 months beyond finding. Now there are some people, it's entirely an individual thing, there's some people that were ill for a few days when they committed the act, and there are other people that are chronically ill and aren't going to get well. So there's all that range.
Mr. Kennedy.
Pardon me. I was going to say, I think that this length of institutionalization factor is not nearly as applicable here because we do have a shorter stay. But I think where it gets into the literature and such is from places like particularly the District of Columbia, which has the Durham rule, and therefore there are all sorts of people who simply should be incarcerated who are sent instead to St. Elizabeth's Hospital, and they do keep them there for a long time. As a matter of fact, they just changed their commitment procedure because they found that St. Elizabeth's Hospital, under the Durham rule, was just getting much too full of people who were not insane, but were in fact criminal. And now they no longer provide for automatic commitment. The person was acquitted by reason of insanity as of about 6 months ago. They must have a separate commitment hearing to see if it is at the time. The other thing I wanted to mentioned was that I don't know that statistics are particularly, well, before bouncing on, I don't think I've ever heard of a lawyer in this Multnomah County opting for a straight defense as opposed to an insanity defense because of demanding to get a shorter period. I think here there is a recognition that acquittal by insanity is generally the better alternative for the client. The other thing I wanted to say is I'm not sure that we should think so much in terms of statistics. One, because they're probably not too meaningful. But I think the important thing when you're talking about an insanity rule is whether or not you're doing justice in the individual given case. as opposed to whether it is an important question in the general scheme of things. In other words, are we going to have a desirable result in this given murder case, or that given murder case, in which rule has shown that it produces desirable results, you know, in the individual cases. You can't minimize it, I don't think, by saying there's only a small number of cases in which the defense has been presented very frequently. For example, a psychiatrist would be appointed in Multnomah County pre-trial for an investigation of the examination of the defendant. The psychiatrist will report to the lawyer and or to the court that the defendant does not measure up to McNaughton, and therefore the man will plead guilty and never is registered as a, you know, as a psychiatric offense, as an insanity offense. So the statistics don't show, you know, what a magnitude of the problem.
Just as an idea, you take a lot of the people out of the criminal process through civil commitment, or do you do it at all?
I think that's frequently determined at the arrest stage. I mean, I suspect that the decision is more frequently made by the police officer than by anybody else. Once the person is in the criminal process, is arrested on a charge of crime, or there is a complaint filed in the, you know, the lower court, the initial court, the probate court will not take jurisdiction of the case, except very rare occasions with very special circumstances. They figure that that is for the criminal court to take care of. And in the criminal court, regular process is followed. If the officers, the police officers involved, or possibly the deputy DA before the case is actually figures that the person is insane, let's say a husband and wife assault or some other assault, most typically, he will start commitment procedures rather than criminal procedures. That's why I say I suspect that it's probably most often determined at the police level.
Ms. Wilson.
Well, my comment is that
after
Frank's original one about the question of disposition, one of the things that the jury study brought up with it, and it would be hard to say from looking at how influential this was in making the decision, but the question of the ultimate disposition does weigh on the willingness or unwillingness of juries to find the person not guilty by reason of insanity. You get the articulated view, well, if he's just going to walk out the front door and it's a borderline case, I'm not so sure I'm going to go along with finding him not guilty by reason of insanity. So that while that may not be the pure way the legal question should be viewed, it evidently does have some influence on jurors, and perhaps they're the kind of a hold out harder juror to convince of insanity anyway. But one of the things, of course, is kind of interesting is that even if you have a mandatory commitment law, this is not one of the things you inform the jury. In Michigan, they're not informed of it, even though, as I understand, they do follow up with it. And so there's much speculation in the jury thing of what's going to happen to him if we do find him not guilty.
That's the rule also in Oregon, although it's a discretionary commitment, but the jury, there is a case, the jury may not be told by the judge in his instructions that if they find him not guilty by reason of insanity, that he may be committed and taken out of society.
Well, this is just another one of the many, many instances in which the law doesn't tell jurors things that maybe they ought to, you know, would influence their decision one way or another. But the thing is, you do notice that the transcripts show a great deal of speculation on the part of the jurors.
I think this point is interesting to discuss because it affects the insanity defense. If the jury is not told that the man may be committed by the court, well, we can say, well, that's fine because that will eliminate
an extra issue.
Trying to think of compromise verdicts by the jury, saying, well, we'll find him guilty by not reason of insanity because we know the judge will put him away, although we don't think that we might find some other way. But the other side of the coin is that they're more inclined to find him guilty of the crime charge because they don't know they can be put away. So you've got an answer. You have a dilemma about what to do or what to tell or not tell a jury.
Okay, sure.
I'm not going to say too much and not enough. The point I agree with your tenets are thorough, that the choice of the rule should depend on how you can best dispose of the individual case. I think we're in a completely kind of frustrated, ambiguous situation with any rule you choose, but I'm embarrassed to cite that one of Kathleen's very close personal friends, the reader James Simon, a sociologist at the University of Illinois and other places, got out a book a year or so ago, The Defense of Insanity, in which she had run a bunch of studies and come to the conclusion of whether you use the Monodic rule, or the Durham rule, or the Model Penal Code rule, really isn't important at all as far as how the case is decided. The jurors, you could have no rule at all, and jurors would still decide the case by the seat of the pants, by the way they feel about the situation, but that it was quite important as far as what testimony is available to the court or to the jury from professionals and from psychiatrists, and that and it seems to me that we really wouldn't be upsetting the apple cart a lot to adopt this Model Penal Code formulation, but we would have some more realistic assistance with the court and the jury from the psychiatrist than we do now have. Now, I feel stupid in that when I sit in the ivory tower and Judge Burns and Frank Knight and Jake are in the court all the time, I assume that in actual practice, in spite of our hanging on to the monopoly rule, that judge allows pretty much leeway in that you get pretty broad psychiatric testimony. You don't hold it down just to period. Didn't know the difference between right and wrong. That's not a realistic view. So we're really not hurting too bad under the present rule on that basis. Is that about right?
The Supreme Court reports indicate that that's correct. Occasionally the transcript part of a psychiatrist's testimony will be inserted. One in particular, I remember, was quite interesting. Allow the psychiatrist wide range, this is generally recognized, wide range for all of mental life, and in particular with respect to the meaning of no under the McNaughton rule. And the McNaughton rule in pure form, of course, is that man didn't know right from wrong. Well, no, what does that mean? The psychiatrist gives it a meaning of intellectual level and one of emotional level. And it's been the old stereotype understanding that no means intellectual only. Cases show that's not true where it's been decided, and it certainly hasn't been true in Oregon, based on the testimony that the Supreme Court approved. No objections were raised, the trial court allowed it in. Psychiatrists testified as to appreciation of wrong, understanding, both levels, in other words, in a wide range with respect to that particular aspect of the McNaughton rule. And this goes right down the line. I think the intimate acquaintance rule in Oregon is very liberally applied, so that even lay testimony is not particularly restricted.
This concerns me. Professor Arthur, you and Mr. Tanzer both raised the point that we should be concerned with the rule that has the best effect in the individual case. I don't understand exactly what you're getting at.
Well,
I know that you prefer rules, but I'd like to have you apply it.
I don't think you can tell much from the numbers, even if the numbers were available. They say that Miranda, for example, isn't very important because there aren't many cases that really depend on confessions. Yet we know, in a given investigation, Miranda can be extremely important. The question, I think, becomes whether the people who really ought to be, and that's subjective, ought to be acquitted by reason of insanity are, or whether the people who ought not to be aren't. I think perhaps the, I'm wondering if you might pass the buck on Dr. Trevett.
Trevett,
pardon me. I'm wondering whether the people who are sent down to the hospital, for example, on not guilty by reason of insanity verdicts, are really appropriately in that hospital, and how many people who are sent to the penitentiary or the correctional institution belong to the hospital instead. I mean, you know, how appropriate a result do we come to, regardless of the semantic definition of the test?
Well, I've never done any specific studies. You know, I'm talking off the top of my head. But I think in general, the experience is that we get the people in the hospital who need to do that. And the people in the penitentiary who can be best served in that institution. I've seen cases of error, particularly in people who have been imprisoned, who were obviously mentally ill at the time they committed the crime, and the defense wasn't raised. I can't think offhand of anybody that's ended up committed to the state hospital who didn't need to be there. And certainly it has happened. If you look hard and long enough, we get an awful lot of people who are sent there for examination, who are raising the defense of not guilty by reason of insanity, who we don't think are insane in any way, shape, or form. And usually, by the time the last decision is made, the people sense the penitentiary when this decision is made.
So that indicates McNaughton appears to be working fairly well. McNaughton, as we have it in Oregon.
Well, it seems to me that I don't know what goes on in court. It's been a long time since I've been there, but it seems to me it works out one way or another. Despite the fact that psychiatrists disagree and you can get two sides in any case.
Well, the argument I've always heard for McNaughton is that it does work, and the rule is relatively easy to apply in courts, relatively definite in courts, given the variations for individual psychiatrists. The argument against Durham has always been, I think we all agree, it just plain doesn't work.
It's really a non-rule.
It's a non-rule. And I just don't know what the experience has been with ALI.
The jury studies that Dan mentioned, they found that the juries that were instructed under Durham and the juries that were not instructed at all just said that he's insane and he'll find him not guilty by reason of insanity, that they came back within such close percentage points that there was no difference as far as the number of not guilty by reason of insanity. So really, Durham is the same as just saying, okay, if he's insane.
Mr. Chairman.
Shaped by the instruction. After all, if they heard it and nobody objected, then when they're majoring against the instruction, they figure it's relevant and they can talk about it, and so they've been given the same kind of information regardless of what the instruction is.
Mm-hmm. With the exception in Oregon and those states that restrict the control test, and I think this is one thing that we ought to add in Oregon. I don't think it's a great expansion of the rule. I think it's simply fills in an area that we ought to fill in, and that is in the model penal code formulation, there is a control test. That is not the irresistible impulse test, because that word is misleading, but it means that if a person knows right from wrong but can't control his actions, has no volitional control, that this is part of the insanity test and there ought to be free testimony on it. I would say that the cases I've seen indicate in one or two odd places that in fact, that kind of testimony is coming in, is being allowed by the circuit court judges.
It sure
and the Supreme
is.
Court isn't offended by it.
Wait.
The only thing the Supreme Court says is you can't instruct on it. Well, if the jury gets the information, that's what's important.
The way that gets in is the more defense-oriented psychiatrist will say, let's say in an assault case, he knows he shouldn't stab somebody, but he can't control himself. The defense psychiatrist testifies that while he generally had capacity to appreciate right from wrong, he was so excited at this moment that he lost that capacity to know right from wrong. And,
he didn't understand the quality.
He didn't understand. Well, he didn't. At that moment, his reason was suspended, for an instance. So while it's not under control, terminology, so much of what we're saying is simply the framework of the psychiatrist's testimony related, I think, rather than, as Frank points out, the result.
Well, let's face a practical problem. A juror is sitting there looking at this fellow in the courtroom, and he's just as normal as apple pie when he's sitting in that courtroom. And they're just going to take an awful lot to convince him that he was insane when 3 months hence or back he committed an act. That's really what it amounts to, and all these jury studies, I think, bear that out. Making notice which rule you apply, the jury man has got the prejudice against the insanity defense. Especially when you can see the fellow looking so sane in court. Otherwise, he wouldn't be there. He wouldn't be competent to stand trial.
Dr.
Connolly.
Particularly if he committed a fairly sane
act,
we know the difference.
With a lot of premeditation, you get it. Buying guns and bullets and that sort of thing.
That's
show
the rational act, after all, to get some money from somebody. It may be irrational. The jury study, incidentally, did follow what I think is more closely the Illinois rule, and that is they did shape the testimony rather strongly to limit it considerably more in its scope and phase when they use McNaughton or what they did in Durham, so that the distinction in Oregon is not quite as true as the textual in this case or in the practice of the United States, so that there is actual restriction. So we gotta go to the states to have are unhappier with the McNaughton distinction because they feel that the thing they don't say is they're not being honest. We're here for you not writing it quite that same.
Dr. Kleinman, did you have?
Well, I had another comment, but in relationship to this point, I think from our everyday practice as psychiatrists, certainly at the hospital, and I think the hospital psychiatrists tend to be a little more conservative than the usual psychiatrist employed for the defense. We really practically don't make any distinction between intellectually knowing and emotionally knowing. What we try and determine, was a man sick, and did he have the ability to act normally, or did he not? And if we feel that the his crime was a result of his mental illness, and his whether it was he didn't know or he couldn't control himself, we usually testify that he was insane. But the thing that I thought might be helpful to your group here would be for me to very briefly review with you what the practice is at the hospital when people are sent to us. Because I sense some concern about, well, they get out too soon or they stay too long or what. We really have two functions in this area. One is, first of all, to advise the court. So we get about 130, 150 people sent to us every year for court-ordered examinations. And we try and do a thorough study, which takes a month or 2 months. We review all of these with the board. I happen to be chairman of that board. We sit on 5 or 6 cases a week on the average. We have that amount of business. And we have our senior psychiatrist review the case history. We see the individual, we interview him, we go over all the notes, the doctor's notes, the aide's notes, the nurse's notes, and collectively we come to a decision after discussion as to whether or not we think this man was sane at the time usually, and is he able to stand trial now, and was his act a result of the mental illness. And then we so advise the court. We can come to an agreement. If we can't, we might keep it longer. So that's one function. So supposing you have a man that we say agree that he was mentally ill at the time he committed the act and he was not guilty by reason of insanity, and he's found so. Then the court commits him to the hospital. At that point, he's just considered the same as anybody else that's committed to the hospital, whether he ever had legal proceedings against him or not. Our responsibility then becomes, first of all, to treat him, and secondly, to supervise him until we feel that he is no longer a menace to society. And usually these people are followed closely by the same board. They're not given any privileges until they're presented before the board in their course of treatment in the hospital reviewed. And this is one of the most difficult judgmental tasks that I have ever been faced with, either as a physician or a public administrator. The responsibility that the physicians in a mental hospital have on their shoulders is tremendous in this regard. You just have to decide whether this man is, you have to weigh the, his needs for freedom, his needs to go about his life when he gets well, versus society's needs to be protected from any further misbehavior on his part. And we weigh this very carefully. And when we think it's reasonable to give the man more freedom, we do so. And often people who have been committed to us for a serious act in the past, we will review repeatedly over a number of 2 or 3 years.
Doctor, I'd like to ask a question. I'm very much interested in what you said